Hello and welcome to this episode of The Mary Trump Show. I am really excited to welcome Jason Kander, former Army captain, the first millennial elected to statewide office as Secretary of State of Missouri, founder of Let America Vote, president of National Expansion at Veterans Community Project, and author most recently of the New York Times bestseller Invisible Storm, a soldier's memoir of politics and PTSD. Jason, it is so great to have you. How are you doing?
I am great, and it's so great to be here. Thanks so much for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Well, you know, I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time just about your experiences in general, and then you wrote this profoundly important and profound book. You know, like many, many Americans, I was familiar with your story and your work in politics, and then what happened after your decision to step away from politics. And, you know, the story, your story in general resonated to me at the most basic level, because I also have PTSD. And it is, as you know, always sort of validating to hear somebody else's experiences. But in this book, you take that to a completely other level, because it is so honest, and you allow yourself in it to be so vulnerable to us that, you know, I wanted to talk to you about the process of writing it, and also how I guess the aftermath of the book, especially in the context of COVID, which, you know, as I'm sure you're aware, has created a mental health crisis, the likes of which I don't think we've seen in this country. So I just wanted to start there with you, the process of writing the book, and how the aftermath of it has been for you.
Yeah. Thank you. You know, the process of writing the book is really interesting and, difficult for all the right reasons. You know, the obvious stuff, I mean, it's difficult to write about your trauma. Interestingly, it was not that difficult for me to write about what the majority of the book is about, which is, you know, going through, you know, the 10 years that I did without, you know, being diagnosed and not realizing that I had PTSD. And also, it wasn't difficult to write about going through therapy, because neither of those was traumatic for me. And so for me, the hardest part of the book to write was the one chapter that's really set in Afghanistan. And it was really purposeful only setting one chapter of the book in Afghanistan because, you know, like, I know that there is a genre out there. I know that there is an audience for the books that are on the shelves of 50 to 75 year old, you know, men in America that are written by like Tom Clancy, war books, right? And I didn't just want to write for that audience. I wanted to write for a larger audience and for people, whether they'd experienced trauma in the military or otherwise. So the process of writing the book, what made it hard was I wanted to make sure that I could make it something that people, whether they had had mental health struggles or not, could understand and relate to. And if I just told the story using the vocabulary and the lexicon that I had gained in therapy, which is where you are in the third act of the book, then people aren't going to connect with it, right? Like if I'm talking about hypervigilance, you know, if you haven't been to therapy, you're like, what is that? But if I'm explaining, well, I felt like I was in danger all the time, and I felt like the world was a very dangerous place, and everybody was naive to this danger, well, that's maybe easier for people to digest. So that was a challenge, but one that I'm glad I took on. And then, you know, sort of the time period that the book ended up coming out in, you know, I did not intend to write a book about national trauma or about like how to deal with it. But what I did intend to do was write a book about the experience of trauma and facing your trauma and what that could lead to post-traumatic growth. And it turns out that between, you know, COVID, like you mentioned, violence, whether it's, you know, across the world or here at parades and grocery stores and schools, or just the basic just experience of watching the news in 2022, I have found that a lot of people have responded to that part of the book in a big, that usefulness of the book in that way.
Yeah. And it's fascinating to see your assessment of that in real time, not as you're writing it, but as you're experiencing your life post-trauma and not realizing just what you were going through. And I think that is common among people who end up being diagnosed with PTSD. You need somebody outside of you to say, that might have been normal for you. Or you might think that that wasn't a big deal, but holy cow. I mean, the fact that a human being could not simply survive it and then thrive afterwards, but then deny the significance of it. That was something that was incredibly powerful for me in reading your book, because there were so many mechanisms in place to prop that myth you had about your experience up. Is that fair to say?
No, absolutely. I mean, some of this is specific to the military, but it really, it can be extrapolated to all of us, right? It's just the military sort of perfected this idea of teaching you that whatever you're going through is no big deal compared to what other people are going through. But there's a practical reason for it, right? Like for me, I'm going into meetings with people who, it might be a trap. They may want to kill me and there's nobody to come and, you know, save me because they don't know where I am. This is in Afghanistan as an intelligence officer, but I'm also getting a steady drumbeat all the way through, as is every soldier, of, well, this is no big deal compared to this person, compared to that person. It's very valuable to me in the job because it's how I go into the next meeting, even with the conscious knowledge that I might not get out of the next meeting with these unsavory characters. Well, you know, if you extrapolate that to the rest of you know, life in America, it's what we talked about a moment ago. It's, you know, I haven't been sleeping. I've been irritable, but it can't be that I saw the news about Uvalde, you know, on TV, because I wasn't affected by that. I wasn't there. So I'm not going to grant that to myself. And then at a higher level in our politics, and this is something that I didn't get into the book, but I really have sort of come to understand during the conversations I've had during this book tour, at a higher level, I feel like the avoidance that I learned about in therapy that I had been engaging in for myself for so many years, avoiding my own disruptive memories and thoughts and emotions through activity and staying busy and everything. Well, when I look at that and I compare it to what we do after a school shooting, for instance, the way a certain segment of the population says, like, it comes up with various ways that they're not going to confront those emotions. On the extreme end, it's that didn't happen. That's not real. On the, you know, and then the lesser end is, well, you know, we're going to talk about whether doors were left locked or unlocked. And then there are also folks who are just like, I know that this is a big problem. I know something needs to be done about it. I'm voting that way, but I'm not going to do more. I can't face that, whether they consciously say that to themselves or not. In our politics, we do at this point a lot of avoidance nationally. And I think it is a big part of why we don't deal with each other and deal with our problems.
And that avoidance creates the space to repeat patterns. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons I think we're having such a difficult time moving beyond this very trying political moment and historical moment we're living in. But it's also why we sort of double down on the need to, I guess, cast things in such a light that we normalize them, which I think is a version of what you were saying. And that then kind of gives other people permission to join us in that. And I think the story of you and your wife and how you went through all of this together and very separately was incredibly moving. And in a way, I don't want to stretch the point too much, but it was sort of a metaphor in my mind for America now, because we've been so divided and so separated and isolated from each other. In some ways, because we're at cross purposes, but in other ways, because we're all on the same side, but you know, we think the best way to get through it together is to enable each other to avoid dealing with the hard stuff, just so we can get through the day. And I think Diana's narration in the book was extremely powerful. So is that how you both, I mean, it seems like you both experienced it that way, not in the moment, because again, we're just going through the motions and we're just trying to get through it, the hard stuff. But as you're writing the book and creating this narrative of your lives retrospectively, that it seemed that what had been your strengths as a couple ended up being weaknesses because you weren't able to adapt to the really traumatic situations you were both dealing with separately.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And Mary, to me, my favorite aspect of the book is my wife Diana's contributions to the book. You know,
yeah, it's actually it's amazing, and you guys should also, in addition to reading it, you should listen to it as well.
Yeah, I mean, because she narrates her parts, and you know, for those who haven't read it, it's each chapter there's about a 2-page passage written in the first person by Diana, and it often always presents a different perspective on what was going on than mine, but it in some cases presents a conflicting perspective. She jokingly refers to her parts in the book as her rebuttals, and to me that's my favorite part, because you know, I'm not the only best-selling author in the family. My wife is very talented, and also because it presents this concept of secondary post-traumatic stress that we were not aware of when I went into therapy, and most people aren't. But the other thing about it is that what it does is it does demonstrate what you're talking about, which is that trauma can drive us apart, and when we don't realize it, and we think we're at odds, and when in reality we're both going after the same thing, and what we have to do is talk. And I do think, we didn't intend it this way, but I do think it's a metaphor for the country in a lot of ways, because we are going through these repeated national traumas. And you know, politicians say all the time, I used to say it as a politician, what we've got to do is we've got to come together around our shared values. Yes, that's true, but we also at a more achievable level first have to come together. It doesn't even have to be around policy. When I live in Kansas City, I live in the middle of the country. I have very good friends whose politics are the complete other end of the spectrum of mine. And, you know, there's not a lot of people probably who are as active as I am in national politics who have friendships with people who genuinely really disagree with me about everything.
Right.
And it is a virtue of living here in the middle of the country. And what is always interesting to me about those conversations is that if we can go back and forth over and over again about what we disagree about and all that, but when you go a little deeper, our fears are so similar. We're afraid of different things, but our fears are similar. I got a friend who has told me he's really worried about the future of the country and what it's going to mean for his kids. Now, his next sentence is about, you know, stuff he'll call like out of control wokeism and all this stuff that they feed him on Fox News. But at a basic level, he and I both have a fear of what the country is turning into for the future. And when he and I talk about that, we make a lot more progress and can find a lot more common ground. And that opens the door for us to talk about politics in ways where we can come to agreement on things in ways people wouldn't expect. And just like in a marriage where we were going through this trauma, we were scared and it was driving us apart. Well, it wasn't until I started to get treatment and she started to get treatment that we developed the tools to talk not about the stuff we disagreed with, but to talk about what we were feeling, to be curious about those emotions. That's when we came back together. And the book ultimately is a love story, which is my favorite part of it.
Yeah, it is. And you two are real partners. And I think it's because of that strong foundation you had that you were able to. No, I don't want to say weather the storm. It was 11 years. It wasn't like this, you know, 2 or 3 day hurricane.
Yeah, yeah.
It was well, 11
years. Well, and we didn't even know we were like in a storm for 10 years. We just thought,
right.
You know, I don't know. We just were like, just go, go, go. This is what life is. And it, yeah.
And that's, that's the one of the many lessons, is that sometimes falling back on your ambition is not the way to go, right. Because it makes it kind of difficult to address anything or change the subject.
Well, falling back on, I mean, you can replace ambition there with anything. I mean, that was right, one exactly. of my other big goals in the book, right? Is that I didn't want anybody to, like, I was aware that I could write a book about trauma and get a large group of people to read it and find out about post-traumatic growth and learn what I had learned. But I was aware that the way to do that and the unique opportunity I had was, I was certainly, you know, this goes without saying anymore, I'm certainly not the only person to run for president while having a secret psychological disorder, obviously, but...
Sorry, that was hysterical.
But I'm
and
the
sad, actually.
And sad. But I'm the only one in history who's copped to it and talked right. about it. And that gave me an opportunity to... I knew that if I told that story for the first two acts... then I could get people to be really invested in the third act, which was, and here's what therapy was like, and here's what I gained out of it, which is what I really wanted to relay to people, right? And so I guess my point here is that what I didn't want in doing that was anybody to read it and go, okay, but you know, I did this and Kanner didn't do that, so what the heck's wrong with me? So yeah. when you say, don't, you know, just rely on your ambition, to me, you can fill in the blank. Don't just rely right. on substances. Don't just rely on whatever it is right. that's, I was fortunate that what was in front of me and available to me as a self-medicating coping mechanism, avoidance strategy, which are all words I didn't have for 11 years,
right.
was my career.
Yep.
But I try to be really clear with people about the fact that if I hadn't had that opportunity and what was in front of me was cocaine, then this could easily be a book about that. And,
that's right.
And there should be no judgment by me of anybody who turned to that instead. You know, it's an addiction yeah. for avoiding yourself is an addiction for avoiding yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was speaking specifically to your experience and your wife's, you know, you right. had, you know, one of your early bonds was you two had the ambition of wanting to make the world a better place and being of service, and which you both mm-hmm. have been and continue to be. But it took on an outsized role. And one of the incredibly important things you do in the book was put it in the terms of addiction and, you know, your concerns after being in therapy for a while of going back into the media. Is it going to give you that same kind of rush? And after it's over, are you going to have the same kind of crash? So you did put it in the terms of addiction, mm-hmm. which does invite people to see their own experiences non-judgmentally through that lens. And you give all of us a vocabulary which many, many people hadn't had before. So I Thanks. Think that helps create the space to have a discussion. Because again, if we think about and how can we not think about it? It's like all we talk about is, you know, the trauma this country's gone yeah. through for the last, well, I say six, but certainly two mm-hmm. years. And it isn't just COVID, as you mentioned. It's the economic crisis. It's the harrowing political crisis that continues to worsen, I think. Yeah. And, you know, when people are faced with that kind of onslaught, right? I said it's very difficult to deal with your trauma or heal your trauma while you're constantly being traumatized. But, you know, you can find space to do that. And as you demonstrate, like the first step to that is allowing yourself to admit that you're struggling. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people don't even allow for that. I remember at the beginning of COVID, friends of mine who were able to work from home or whatever, they would start to talk about how terrified they were. And they'd say, well, you know, so many people have it worse than I do, which sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah. right.
And that's the thing is, like, I went a lot of years thinking I could rank my trauma out of existence, right? Like what I thought I was doing was I thought I was giving myself perspective, right? So I, you know, I was struggling with night terrors. I was struggling with this hypervigilance, this feeling of being in danger all the time and self-loathing eventually and depression and, you know, some other fun stuff. But I would say to myself, Well, you know, I didn't get physically wounded, right? Like I had, I had a friend who had come home and had taken his own life. I had, a friend, a guy I had served with, who had, been shot by a sniper and was forever changed. And so I thought what I was doing was saying to myself, well, you're not like those guys, you know, but what I was really saying to myself was, you have no right to treat any of this or think of any of this as trauma because you know people, so many people who have had it so much worse. Or in my case, because I did one deployment, it was, you know, you have friends who have done so much more. You have friends who are still doing it and you're not. Yep. You know, when I was going through stressful things that were exacerbating my own trauma, it was, so what, you might lose an election. Like, who are you to think of that as something that needs to be addressed, you know, in your mental health? Like, come on, you know, suck it up and drive on, like a soldier would say, right? And that's the thing, is like, I didn't actually gain any perspective, and I didn't diminish my trauma by trying to rank it against other people's trauma. All I did was delay my opportunity to heal. And, you know, trauma doesn't get better with time. It actually gets worse with time. So it's why in the book, I compare it to a physical injury. You know, if I had tried, you know, I had hurt my knee right before I went into the Army, right? And then I ended up having to get surgery, physical therapy. But what I did with my brain after I got out of the Army, or after I got home from Afghanistan, was as if I had gone into the Army without ever getting the surgery or the physical therapy on my knee. And I was like, I'm just going to tough it out. Well, by the time, first of all, I wouldn't have been able to make it. But if I'd had, you know, my leg would be mangled.
Right.
But that's what I did with my brain. I'm going to walk it off. And after a while, it just got worse, and so much worse than it needed to be.
Yeah. And I think that's, on the one hand, that's kind of a testament to what a lousy job we do in the West of helping people understand and deal with mental illness. You know, we have this really crazy idea that mental health and physical health are two completely separate things, right? And that mental health is a luxury, or mental illness is kind of a character flaw, perhaps. Right. And it's very dangerous, especially when we're dealing with this on a mass scale. And one of the services you do is you know, what you just said, you help people understand that it is not a competition. And, you know, it's not about that. You can get PTSD by being in a horrible, life-threatening accident, or you can get it by watching one. You know, it just depends on all sorts of variables, but it doesn't matter. And in fact, it sort of reminds me of one of my life mottos, is don't live your life comparatively, because you can never win that kind of contest. So I think that you do help people. I don't want to say, normalize. Not that it's normal, or not that trauma should be normalized. It obviously needs to be treated, but the experience needs to be normalized, and any kind of shame needs to be taken out of the equation. And one of the things that I think is so instrumental is, and I think I mentioned this at the beginning, is how vulnerable you allow yourself to be so publicly, because that takes an enormous amount of courage. You know, sucking it up and pretending everything's fine, that's not courage. Facing it and being vulnerable in front of people when you know you might be judged by a lot of them, that takes courage.
Oh, I appreciate it. You know, I think for me, once I had made the decision in October of 2018 that I was, you know, going to be public about why I was stepping away from public life, and had made that decision that, you know, I would tell people that I had had suicidal thoughts and that I was struggling with PTSD. You know, once I made the decision to be public about that, after that, it kind of broke the seal, right? And so, obviously, there are parts of the book that it's a memoir by somebody from politics where they don't like come off great on every page, which is unique, right? Usually it's like a campaign pamphlet where you're like, page is, and that's why I'd like to get your vote. But the other thing it did for me, honestly, is that, and part of the incentive, if there was a selfish incentive for me, or I guess more like if there was a bonus for me, was that once you make an announcement like that and you tell people, hey, I've had suicidal thoughts, I'm going to go get help for this. If you don't tell people the rest of the story, everybody you encounter who doesn't know you really well after that kind of just assumes that you're continuously at rock bottom. And and so it is a strange feeling to like to go through therapy, to reach a stage of post-traumatic growth, to really be living a very happy life, which is where I am now, and be able to feel this sort of projected sympathy. It's confusing, to be honest, at times. And so I guess for me, what I got out of all of it was if I could tell people the whole story, it, you know, obviously the main objective was this is the book that I wish had existed 14 years ago when I got home and I knew I could help a lot of people. But what I got out of it was, you know, the other parents of the kid, of the kids on the Little League team, my son's Little League team that I coach, the people who I deal with every day in my life, if they read the book, then I know that they, when they are, when they look at me, they're able to see a lot more than PTSD and they're able to see the whole story. And I don't feel like there's just this unspoken thing. I can say, you know, here's the rest of the story. And when people have read this book, I feel like, well, you understand me and you understand my motivations and you're not like, okay, so is he okay? Like, is he going to combust at any moment? You know, that's a benefit to me personally.
And also the other, on the other side of that, and this actually for me personally was a really profound insight. And I guess I'd never thought about it this way, but when you were having a bad few days, you'd been in treatment for a while, you were doing much better, because I guess it was a few months in, and you go to therapy and your therapist is like, yeah, you're not always going to have a good day. Nobody always has good days. And you're like, oh my God, it's like really freeing to understand that, you know, things aren't always going to be horrible, but things aren't always going to be great either. So I thought that was sort of an important lesson for those of us who have the tendency to beat ourselves up if we're not operating at 100% all the time.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I had spent all those years playing whack-a-mole with my emotions, right? Because like the one thing I didn't want to do was be alone with myself and my memories and my thoughts. And so then once I had dealt with a lot of that stuff, the idea of going backwards was just really scary, right? So then I go through like a few days where I just felt really low and really depressed. And so I go to Nick, my therapist, and I'm like, thinking I'm sliding backwards, you know, it's like sand going through your fingers. Is it all? Right. And you're just, you know, you've worked so hard to build that up and it's so frightening. So yeah, when he was like, you know, I said, I think I'm depressed again. And he's like, sounds like you're just having a bad few days. And, right. and like, to me, the idea that I was allowed to do that was a revelation. And,
yeah.
And then to be able to say like, okay, yeah, today was not good. Well, I get another chance tomorrow. That self-compassion was a skill that is a super important skill that I gained in treatment.
Yeah. And we could all use more of that. And I think we could use more of that collectively, which, you know, I absolutely want to talk about your work with Veterans Community Project, but I want to go back for a second to talk about something you said earlier about having friends who are on the opposite end of the political spectrum. And I live in New York. And when I'm not in New York, I spend time in Massachusetts. So, and I mean New York City. So I'm like in the two most liberal places on the planet. Right. I don't have to make those accommodations for anybody because there isn't anybody in my circle who's on the opposite end of the political spectrum. But it reminds us how important it is to try to stake out those places where we can have dialogue and find commonality, because I think we are at this very dangerous place where that's becoming less and less possible. And we see it. And as somebody who is a Democrat, who's not just lived, but succeeded politically in a very red state. And as somebody who's been in the military, who's valued your military experience and obviously cares deeply about the military and veterans and where this country is going, are you surprised about the radicalization we're seeing in certain elements in our society, and you know, the news that we're, it's like 20% of the people at the January 6th insurrection were active or former military. We see this list of Oath Keeper membership being published, and a lot of people on the right and in currently in politics on the ballot in places in the military. Does that surprise you? Do you feel in, especially in conversations with people who are coming at everything from such a different place, do you find that there are ways that we can grapple with that and maybe turn that around? Because it does feel like it's a big part of the problem we're facing.
Yeah. I'm not going to say I'm surprised by it, but I'm really worried about it, right? Because obviously radicalization of, I don't worry about it as much for the reasons that, you know, I think a lot of people worry about it because they're like, okay, if we have like, you know, violence, you know, it's obviously, and look, that is concerning, right? If you, if you're going to like the idea that 20% of the people at the insurrection had military experience is very concerning. I worry actually for a much more starkly upsetting reason, which is that if we end up in that sort of, you know, protracted conflict, that sort of civil war, I worry about the institutions holding up. I worry about law enforcement holding up. I worry about the military holding up. Now, with that said, the reason that I don't find it surprising, it's twofold. One is that when you come out of the military, so the first reason is a little bit lesser, and the second reason is a, to me, a bigger reason that doesn't surprise me. So the lesser reason is when you come out of the military, it is a disorienting experience. It is a jarring experience, right? Like you, your identity is now like so confusing, right? Like you were part of this thing and now you're not. And on top of that, everyone around you was part of the same thing. And now, like in a world where so few people serve and it's the longest period of, you know, consecutive time without mandatory service of any kind in our country's history, there's so few people you're going to go back to and be around who have also served, so few people who it feels understand you. And so that's why really productive organizations that give you an opportunity to be part of something greater, stuff like Veterans Community Project, stuff like Team Rubicon, all that sort of thing, that's really important, you know, because in the vacuum, when people are like looking for greater meaning, looking for something to belong to, they are susceptible to radicalization of any type, right? So that's part of why it doesn't surprise me. But the biggest reason it doesn't surprise me is because, you know, I get asked a lot a different version of this question. I get, well, why are so many veterans, why are so many members of the military conservative, right? And to me, this is why it doesn't surprise me. You have to look at the demographics, right? Like, it's not that people in the military are naturally conservative. It's that the military is a workplace that is like 80% minimum male and vastly disproportionately drawn from the South and the Midwest. Well, if you told me any workplace in the country was 80% dudes who were mostly from the Midwest and the South, I'd be like, that is a heavily Republican workforce, right? So that, so it's important, I think, for all of us to keep that in mind, is that a lot of this is just, at this point in America, one of our problems is we kind of inherit our politics the way we sort of inherit our religion. And so just the fact that in 2020, the majority of active duty and veteran voters voted for Biden is a huge deal. It doesn't mean that they're now Democrats. It means the majority of a demographic that is overwhelmingly Republican chose not to vote for Trump. So that's a huge deal. And that gives me reason for optimism.
Yeah, I think it should. And it, I think it puts things in perspective too. You know, we hear about the worst, and obviously having 20% of people at the insurrection, that's not a good number, but at the same time, it's 20% of a not very big number. So, I think as long as we're as vigilant about it, but clearly, the message is that we fail at the beginning and at the end of the process in terms of recruitment and in terms of welcoming people back, and which we don't do. Because again, a tiny percentage of people serve. I don't think America as a country does much to help those of us who never have and never will understand what that means. And again, I think the the failure to help people acclimate is, it makes perfect sense in those terms that people would find any way to belong to anything. So, you know, we should have a little bit of compassion and understanding, at least to a point, and then take it upon ourselves as a society to take some responsibility for that. Because, you know, people like you and others who serve sacrifice a lot and come back and, you know, you can't even get an appointment at the VA for 6 months, right?
Well, and I think the other thing that in order to incentivize our society to do that, well, we have to recognize right now we have a tendency to talk about veterans' issues through using language that is very charity-oriented language, right? Like, right. Like, you know, when employers talk about jobs that they, you know, veterans they've hired, they tend to talk about it kind of like the same way they talk about volunteer hours, right? Like, yep. Look at all these people we helped. And one of the things we have to change is we have to do a better job, and you alluded to this, of helping people who haven't served understand what the enormous value that people have in our society, in our workplace. So for instance, like, you know, this thing recently where, you know, and again, in their search to find ways to talk about stuff with school shootings that isn't about guns, where you have people proposing that we turn veterans into security guards at schools. And it's like, okay, actually we can do stuff other than like stand a post, right?
Yeah.
And that's the thing is like, we need more civilian employers to understand that, you know, if you have spent 4 years in the Army or in the Marine Corps, for instance, and you've done it, you know, during this period where we've had 20 years of war, that means whatever your job was, by the end of your 4 years, you had probably 10 people reporting to you. You're responsible for millions of dollars in really important equipment. And you were like dad or mom away from home of those soldiers or those Marines, for instance. You were their everything. So I don't care what your job was in the military, you are ready. I would rather have you than a new Harvard MBA in a management position in my company. And if we can have more people understand that enormous value that veterans can bring to the workplace, to the community, we're going to have a lot easier time incorporating them. But the way to get there is for us to better, as you said, to better understand what it is they did, what it is they faced, and how, and have them feel as though they can be open and talk about those things without feeling like it's separating them from the rest of the community they're returning to.
That's right. You know, people in that position have skills, have marketable skills. You're giving a job, if you're giving a job to a veteran, you're not doing them a favor. you're actually
doing yourself a favor.
That's right. And it needs to be seen in those terms. And I think part of the problem is, besides the lack of understanding, is the ways in which veterans get treated kind of gives people the wrong idea about what it means to be a veteran. And, you know, part of that is stereotypes, of course. And, you know, I think the worst we saw of that was during in the aftermath of Vietnam. But, you know, we still need to do a better job of dispelling those negative stereotypes people have. And I think in your experience with the VA was very illuminating in that way. So I want to talk, why don't you talk a little bit about that, but also, you know, how you became involved in the Veterans Community Project, which is a beautiful organization, and the role you now have, because I think you guys are doing really important work.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it. Yeah, let me start with the first part, which is, you know, the portrayal of veterans, particularly combat veterans, and frankly, just people with PTSD in general. I mean, one of the really tragic things about this is that veterans seem to be the only people in American society who have been given license to have PTSD, when in reality, like, it's not necessary to be a combat veteran to have PTSD, right?
It is
like,
not.
It is not. Very common. And so for me, I went into therapy and I, you know, I started to get better right after a few months. And I remember saying to my therapist, like, did I even have PTSD? Like, all, it seems like nobody gets better. And, you know, I'm making all this progress. Like, I started to feel bad about it. I started to feel like it was not legitimate. And that's when he told, that's when he pulled out all these studies the VA had done and showed me that you're supposed to get better, that the vast majority of people who had committed to the program had done the homework they were given by their therapist, that they do get better. They, you know, you don't get cured, but you get to a point where PTSD is not disruptive to your life, right? And so I had not known that. And what occurred to me was the reason I had not known that was because I had virtually never seen it. You know, when we are exposed to the idea of PTSD in our culture, it's usually on screen or sometimes, you know, in the news, but it is almost always what I refer to as PTSD porn. It's this voyeuristic, you know, usually a combat vet who has just gone from beating their spouse to robbing a bank to using, you know, substances. And what we don't see hardly ever is what is way, way, way more common, which is people who've been to treatment, achieved post-traumatic growth, gone on with their life and are living well. And that was one of my big motivations in writing the book, was to demonstrate and model post-traumatic growth so that there was an example of that out there. Now, to get to the other part of this, which I really appreciate, which is about Veterans Community Project. Now, before I got to that point, got into therapy, when I first went to the VA had said to me that, you know, it was probably going to be a few months before I could get enrolled. Now, 6 weeks before that, I had gone and part of my campaign, I had toured this place in my hometown in Kansas City, Veterans Community Project, which was just incredible, right? It was doing stuff that, I, you know, as a politician, I've toured a lot of nonprofits, and it was rare that I was just knocked out by one, you know? Right. But they were doing two things. They had a walk-in operation for any veteran where they were just hooking veterans up with any service they need with a super low barrier to entry, I mean, no barrier really to entry other than you're a veteran, and with no bureaucracy. And that was saving lives. And then on top of that, what they were better known for is they had created this village of tiny houses with wraparound case management services. And they were transitioning homeless veterans into being fully functioning members of the community out in the community at a success rate that nobody had ever seen. Right. So I go and I tour it and I go home that night and I tell my wife, like, I wish I could quit everything and go work there, right? But it wasn't like a realistic notion. I was a politician. 6 weeks later, I go to the VA. I kind of hit rock bottom. They tell me it's going to be months before I can start. And I was about to announce the next day, I'm stepping back from everything to go to the VA to get help. And I called my buddy Brian, who was the founder of Veterans Community Project and the CEO. And I'm like, I'm making this announcement tomorrow. I don't know what to do. So he's like, just come on down here. So 6 weeks after the VIP, you're going to be the mayor tour. Mm-hmm. I walked through the front doors of the outreach center like thousands of other Kansas City vets. And just like other vets, they handled my paperwork for me. A week later, I had my first therapy appointment at the VA. So I became a huge believer in it. After I start having some success in therapy, I start hanging around VCP, Veterans Community Project, all the time. And at that time, they had been so successful in Kansas City that all these other communities around the country were saying, hey, can you bring this to our town? And, you know, they had never really envisioned going national, but they wanted to try to help more people. And I had created a national organization, so I'm giving them some advice. And finally, you know, Brian was like, look, man, you seem to be doing pretty well. You're hanging out here a lot. You're not working. You're figuring out what you want to do next. He's like, instead of giving us advice, like, how about you come on full time? So 3 years ago, I became the president of National Expansion. And we have now expanded to the Denver area, into the Sioux Falls area, St. Louis area, Oklahoma City. We're now going into the Milwaukee area. We've got more stuff planned for after that, more campuses to build. And all of the royalties from Invisible Storm go to Veterans Community Project. And it's the best civilian job I've ever had.
That's amazing. So it's about replicating and scaling and filling a void that I wish didn't exist. It would be great if we could figure out a way to make our bureaucracy less complicated and put the vast resources that should be at the disposal of that's to this kind of project. But the fact that you're doing the work is phenomenal. I mean, this has to be one of the best, most uplifting transitions, career transitions I've ever heard about.
it's been very good for me, yeah.
Yeah, right? And it just goes to show you, you never know what can happen if you face your demons and get help, which you help take the... what am I trying to say? You help take the stigma out of that in a way that needs to happen more often. You know, especially for a vet, you know, that preconceived notion that vets are just tough guys and just take it.
Well, I think for me, it is about the stigma. But I also think the really rewarding part of writing the book and of the work I'm doing, but in this case, you know, mostly of the book, is making it accessible, right? Because before I had never been to therapy before. So to me, like anything you've never done before, it just doesn't feel accessible. It's overwhelming, the idea of doing it, right? And so it's why, like in the whole third act of the book, one of the things I do is I literally went and got my records, like the VA records, so that I could put my therapist's actual notes word for word in the book, because I wanted people to feel like they were in these therapy sessions with me and see the progression so that they could envision themselves in the same situation. And I just sort of wanted to open up therapy and make it a lot less mysterious and feel a lot more accessible and doable. And so, you know, it's not the role in public service I originally envisioned for myself. But at the same time, over the last 4 years, almost 4 years now, since I stepped away from elected politics, electoral politics, anyway, I'm still an activist. But in that 4 years, I have unquestionably, definitely done way more good for my family and for myself, but unquestionably had a much greater impact in that 4 years on the world, I think, than I did in the 10 years that I was in elected politics. And I don't even think it's close.
Yeah. And again, you do, in the book, such a good job of helping people or letting people into the experience, which for a lot of us is a foreign, scary experience of therapy. And particularly when, you know, you're suffering from a disorder that requires facing feelings that you've in your entire life or your entire adulthood been told you shouldn't have. Not even feel, but you shouldn't have them at all. So again, I think it was an act of bravery. And I personally am incredibly grateful to you for the book. Everybody should get it and read it. One, because it's powerful and it will, whether you suffer from PTSD, you know somebody who does, and you probably know somebody who does, it's really extraordinary. It's also funny. It's a great read. I mean, it's incredibly well written. It's a good story. And, you know, again, Diana's contribution is one of the best parts of it as well. But you buy it and all of the proceeds are going to VCP, which is phenomenal. And Jason Kander, I'm really grateful that you spent so much time with me today. And I'm also incredibly grateful for all of your work. Keep it up and keep us posted on what comes next.
I will. And Mary, thank you for everything you do and for the time. I really enjoyed the conversation and I appreciate it very much.
All right. Thanks so much, Jason. Take care.
You too.
I hope you found that as interesting and important as I did. I think Jason he's a great guy, but also the work he's doing and the courage he's shown in sharing his story is there quite something. So thank you again to Jason Kander for being here tonight. And of course, thank you to all of you. I so appreciate your coming on the show and not coming on the show. That would be crowded, but coming to see the show and all of your comments and all of your support. It's always a wonderful thing to see. So we're going to leave it there for tonight. We will of course be back next Tuesday at 12 PM Eastern, 9 AM Pacific, for the strategy sessions. That's at youtube.com/politicon. And we'll be back next Thursday with an interview with David Korn, who's just coming out with a new book that is an excellent fascinating read. So it will be great to catch up with David. So that is next Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific, also at youtube.com/Politicon. And while you're on Politicon's YouTube page, be sure to subscribe to Politicon. It doesn't cost anything. It just, you know, the bigger those subscription numbers are, the more people will be able to find the show. And also like the episode, leave a comment, and don't forget to ring the bell, because that way you will be sure to get any videos, episodes, and extra quick hits videos that I'm doing. You'll be sure to get them as soon as they drop. And of course, you can listen to the show in podcast form on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you could give the show a 5-star review, that would be great, because it really, really does help other people find the show. And, you know, it's crunch time. We are less than 7 weeks away. Not seven. I think we're less than 9 weeks away. I think it's 60 days or something until the election. So we really, really are trying to get the word out and help as many people as possible hear the voices of people who come onto the show. So we will see you next Tuesday. And in the meantime, have a great weekend. Stay safe and be kind.